Hi, this is Bill Radke. Now on KUOW's The Record, let's take you on a trip down memory lane. Back to 2013, state governments around the USA were wooing Boeing so that the company would build its 777X plane in their state. Well, Washington State was the winning suitor, and Boeing builds the 777X in Everett. Boeing's reward for choosing Washington? Billions of dollars in tax breaks from our state legislature. Today, the World Trade Organization ruled those tax breaks are illegal. Here to explain is Dominic Gates, the aerospace reporter for the Seattle Times. Hi, Dominic.
Hi, Bill.
Why did the WTO find these tax breaks illegal?
Well, it's because of a clause that the Washington State Legislature inserted into the tax incentive package. They were trying to prevent Boeing from doing what it did on the 787 Dreamliner, which is it agreed to build it here. They did build it here. They got their tax incentives. But then, a few years later, they decided to build another 787 line in South Carolina. And as it turned out, it's the South Carolina plant that will be building the larger model of the Dreamliner exclusively. It won't be built here. So when they came back to extend the tax incentives in 2013, they inserted a clause saying that if any final assembly or wing assembly was sited outside the state of Washington, then the tax breaks, the B&O tax reduction, would be terminated. Now, that's the clause that got them into trouble, because the WTO interpreted that to mean that the law was requiring domestic production, domestic assembly of the wing and final assembly, rather than imported. So if we take the 787, its wing was built in Japan. This clause that the legislature inserted would mean that Boeing couldn't make, it had to make its wings here. It couldn't also decide to let Mitsubishi make 777X wings in Japan. That's illegal under the WTO rules. They have, at least that's what they have ruled today.
And how does this ruling affect Boeing?
Well, will it have any effect at all is the question. The WTO has ruled that this is what's called a prohibited subsidy, which is the most sort of strict term they can use. And technically it means that that subsidy has to be withdrawn within 90 days. Now, it isn't going to happen. The fact is, I've been writing about WTO rulings for a dozen years. There have been two previous cases before this one. They're still going on. Neither Boeing nor Airbus has changed anything of their behavior. Airbus still gets launch aid loans from the European governments. Boeing still gets tax incentives from Washington State and other states. So nothing has changed in 12 years. And actually, lawyers on both sides don't expect this ruling to actually change Washington State's position. It certainly isn't going to mean that Boeing's going to pay more taxes to Washington State. It isn't going to happen. And I would remind you that in the 2013 legislation extended the tax breaks, but when they were originally agreed back in 2003 for the 787, the state actually signed an agreement with Boeing. It's called Project Olympus Agreement. And that agreement said, and I'll quote, "In the event of a change in the law or any other act, event, or circumstance that diminishes the benefit to Boeing, then the state must make the jet maker whole with some other commitment having economic effect equivalent to the tax breaks."
Really? So Washington State, it's the, even if these tax breaks are there, if after all the appeals they're found prohibited and illegal, Washington State taxpayers have to make it up to Boeing so that it doesn't cost Boeing a dime?
That's right. They're not off the hook. That was written in 2003, and even if Boeing lost all the way and somehow the tax breaks had to be quashed, the state would have to find some other way to compensate an equivalent amount.
Is this by design? I mean, does the WTO set up the rules and also set it up so actually the big corporations will be fine no matter what?
The WTO didn't set it up this way. Boeing Boeing insisted on that clause being written in when it did the agreement back in 2003. The WTO is this international body that's supposed to police trade agreements. The question is whether they have any real impact at all. So far, we don't see any. Now, Boeing's insisting there is another case against Airbus, and it's going to come to a head sort of middle of next year. And Boeing's insisting that even though they just lost this round on this separate case, that come next summer, they'll be in a position to instigate trade sanctions against the European Union. I mean, the U.S. will be able to. I'll believe that when I see it. Nothing has happened in 12 years. So far, Airbus argues that the only way out of this is a settlement. And it's very hard to see any changes in behavior by either company.
He'll believe it when he sees it, and he ought to know. Dominic Gates, the Seattle Times aerospace reporter, reacting to this finding today by a World Trade Organization panel that those Washington state tax breaks are illegal. It just sounds like it won't add up to much when it comes to the Boeing company itself. Dominic Gates, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
It's KUOW's The Record. Now let's talk about another contested situation here on The Record. The recount of presidential votes starts this week in Wisconsin, where Donald Trump won by only 22,000 votes. The recount request came not from Hillary Clinton, but from the Green Party candidate Jill Stein, although the Clinton campaign says it will participate. Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Chuck Kornbach has been following. Hi, Chuck.
Good afternoon.
Wisconsin's had some practice at statewide recounts. You did it for a judge's race a few years ago. What kind of task is this?
Well, it's very large in some counties and smaller in others, but it's coming at a time of year when the counties, there are 72 in Wisconsin, counties are trying to get property tax bills out and deal with other local government concerns. And I've been talking with some clerks today that are planning a very busy 2 weeks starting on December 1st.
2 weeks, yes, that's the deadline. First of all, let's talk about what the recount request is about. Is Jill Stein alleging some kind of fraud?
Well, she claims that the voting machines used in Wisconsin and elsewhere were subject to potential hacking or malware put in that would affect the accuracy of the count. She says she and her local people in Wisconsin are saying it's not about helping Hillary Clinton. It's about assuring the integrity of the voting process. And she raised $5-7 million to pursue this in Wisconsin and potentially, it seems, now in Michigan and Pennsylvania.
Stein requested that this recount be done by hand, but Wisconsin denied that request. Why?
Well, right now it's going to be up to the county, but stay tuned. Ms. Stein and her supporters have gone to court in Dane County, Madison, the area this afternoon. In response to this morning, the Wisconsin Election Commission leaving it up to the counties. The counties said, listen, the vote margin is 22,000. Things might change a little bit, but not going to change dramatically. They think that the system works well. The Selection Commission, which is made up of Democrats and Republicans, say that the process works pretty well. They're open to some scrutiny, of course, but they're saying leave it up to the county. And now, in this afternoon, I just spoke with the Milwaukee County Clerk, Joe Zarneski, who says, we're going by machine recount, just putting the ballot back in the machine and let the ballot in this optical reader machine, letting the machine recount it. He says the machines work well and that it's potentially more accurate than a hand recount, which involves one person reading how the ballot looks and other people recording what the ballot said and then trying to tabulate all that. I also talked to the clerk in Jefferson County, a smaller county west of Milwaukee, between Milwaukee and Madison, only 43,000 votes there. The clerk there said, we're going to go by hand. That's what the petitioner wanted, and we think we can bring together enough people. But again, they've only got 43,000 to count. Milwaukee County, several hundred thousand ballots to relook at.
Right. Now, Hillary Clinton's campaign says, we didn't ask for this recount, but we'll participate. What's the difference?
Well, they're going to apparently they want legal representation. I don't know if they're going to be sitting in the court if there's a hearing today on the Green Party's petition for a hand recount. But I think they're going to have people, observers in at least some of the counties watching how things are going. And if there are legal issues raised, they're talking about, as I say, having legal representation to jump in. I think it's probably correct. I know at least one Democrat who gave money to the Green Party effort. The presumption is that many Democrats sent in money because they wanted to look at this these numbers.
You mentioned the deadline being about 2 weeks away, December 13th. Will the Wisconsin recount be finished by then?
Well, the two clerks I spoke with today said it's going to be difficult, arduous. They're talking about working six-day weeks, 12-hour days, having their teams bringing in Milwaukee County clerks from the 19 municipalities, poll watchers that have worked, poll precinct captains and so on. People will get paid, and that helps contribute to the cost. Milwaukee County's cost tentatively in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Jefferson County, the smaller county, more than $100,000. So there will be pay for these people, but they're going to have to work awfully hard for whatever they get. And the December 13th deadline seems pretty firm. It's against a federal law requiring the recounts in presidential races to be wrapped up within 35 days of the election. That would peg it for December 13th. Conceivably, lawyers could go to court and alter that a bit, but right now it's supposed to be done by the 13th.
What would happen if on December 19th, that's when the Electoral College, the states meet to cast their votes? Could they cast their votes for Trump if there's still an ongoing recount happening?
Well, it seems odd, but apparently the case is that the missing that deadline could put Wisconsin's 10 electoral votes up for grabs. I'm sure lawyers for the state, for the Trump campaign and others would go to court to try to extend the deadline or make exceptions and so on. But that's the threat that's supposedly out there.
Amazing. And this will be repeated potentially in other states. We've been talking with reporter Chuck Kornbach from Wisconsin Public Radio. Chuck, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
President-elect Donald Trump is back to meeting with potential members of his upcoming administration today after this holiday weekend dominated by his criticizing this recount effort. And we're talking about Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan. Trump went on a 12-hour Twitter offensive in which not only did he say it was sad that the Clinton campaign is participating, but Trump also made claims that millions of votes were cast illegally, claims for which he offered no evidence. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. With the elections we just had around America, California and three other states have now joined Washington and others in legalizing the recreational use of marijuana. Four more states voted for medical cannabis as well. But the burgeoning cannabis industry has been relying on an Obama administration policy of tolerating state laws that regulate a drug that is still illegal federally. Is the Trump administration going to be so tolerant? From Jefferson Public Radio, Liam Moriarty reports.
It's been 2 years since voters in Oregon approved a measure to allow adults to grow, buy, possess, and consume marijuana for recreational use. And while buying weed in Oregon isn't quite as simple as walking into your corner 7-Eleven and picking up a six-pack, it's pretty easy. I recently walked into Breeze Botanicals in Gold Hill, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi there.
How are you doing today?
Pretty well. I'd like to buy some cannabis.
Oh, good.
The owner, Bree Malarkey, checks me in, inspects my ID, then leads me into the locked showroom.
Welcome to the other side of the wall.
Where she displays an impressive array of medicinal herbs, including marijuana, in glass jars. After quizzing Malarkey about the effects of various strains, I make my choice. Watermelon Kush.
I'll take a gram of that.
Yep, absolutely.
Excellent. Wrap it up.
I pay, put my purchase in the legally required childproof container, and I'm out the door. This now legal transaction happens tens of thousands of times a day in Oregon, Washington, Colorado, and Alaska. What's allowed this to happen, since marijuana remains illegal under federal law, is a 2013 policy memo by then-Deputy Attorney General James Cole. The so-called Cole memo says that if states make effective efforts to keep pot away from kids, prevent driving while high, and address other concerns, the feds will look the other way. Will a Trump administration continue that policy? At a rally in Nevada a year ago, candidate Trump gave this answer.
I think medical should happen, right? Don't we agree? I mean, I think so. And then I really believe you should leave it up to the states. It should be a state situation.
But Trump has expressed less supportive opinions on other occasions, and his nominee for attorney general, Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, has very firm ideas of his own. Here's Sessions at a Senate hearing last April.
This drug is dangerous. You cannot play with it. It's not funny. It's not something to laugh about. And trying to send that message with clarity that good people don't smoke marijuana.
John Hudak says it's hard to say where the Trump administration will come down on this issue.
There is reason for us to believe that either outcome, either a pro-states rights outcome or a pro-prohibition outcome, could happen.
Hudak is a senior fellow at the D.C.-based Brookings Institution who's made a study of cannabis policy. He points out that the legal foundation on which the marijuana industry rests is pretty precarious.
The Cole memos can be rescinded by the stroke of the pen of the Attorney General.
But Troy Dayton isn't too worried. Dayton is CEO of the Arcview Group, a San Francisco-based investment and market research firm that focuses on cannabis. He acknowledges that if Sessions is appointed AG, and if Trump gives him scope to set his own policy,
that would be devastating to the cannabis industry.
But Dayton remains bullish on the industry's future. He points to the growing success of legalization measures and to polls showing more than 60% of Americans support legal pot.
There is more political cost to going against the grain here than going with the grain.
And Dayton says he thinks Trump is unlikely to spend his political capital trying to put the marijuana genie back in the bottle. Attorney Henry Wieckowski agrees.
The more people that know how to grow it and appreciate the benefits of using it, the harder and harder it's going to be to stop.
Wieckowski is a prominent San Francisco lawyer who's represented many cannabis businesses during years of legal battles with the feds. He notes that since 2014, Congress has passed a budget rider that bars the Justice Department from using federal funds to interfere with state medical marijuana laws. And in 2015, a federal court slapped down a Justice Department attempt to circumvent the measure. Wieckowski thinks it's likely Congress will extend that protection to states with recreational use laws as well.
Why would anybody want to deprive the states of the ability to regulate and tax cannabis and open up that market back to the illegal cartels?
At Breeze Botanicals, the herb shop in Oregon, owner Bree Malarkey recognizes the uncertainty that hangs over her business. But she says she creates jobs, she pays taxes, and works hard to do right by her employees and her clients. And she remains optimistic.
I keep saying to myself, if you know what you're doing is right and you're leading by example and you're trying to be a good citizen, you just keep fighting for what you know is right.
About 3 in 5 Americans now live in a state with some form of legal cannabis. Analysts say the industry is worth nearly $7 billion this year, and as the new states, including California, come online, that value is projected to approach $22 billion by 2020. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. Interfaith leaders in Seattle are calling for an FBI investigation. They allege a hate crime happened to a Muslim student on the University of Washington campus 1 week after the presidential election. The woman who was attacked is Nazro Hassan, a freshman computer programming student. Hassan told KUOW's David Hyde she had just walked out of Mary Gates Hall on campus when she was struck in the head with a bottle.
I had a black eye and a really, really bad concussion. Like, this whole side of my face was purple.
What did you think the motivation was for the attack?
I was just shocked. I was like, was it because of I was wearing hijab? Is it because of the color of my skin? Like, he didn't give me a reason or he didn't say anything. So I was just baffled and confused, really.
And this is just 1 week after the presidential election, where we know there have been a number of hate-related incidents. What are your thoughts about that?
There were protests going on about the Donald Trump election, going on all around our campus, all around Seattle, everywhere I go. Like, for like the past couple of days before then, there was like a lot of stuff going on campus. So
What conversations have you had with friends and family about this afterwards?
Everyone just mostly asked me, like, how am I doing? And I'm just like, I'm fine. And yeah, I tried to remind them that, you know, it's not because of who we are, because we're good people. And I don't know what else to say to them.
Your family must be really worried about it. Mm-hmm. What have they said to you?
They say don't go out at night and don't walk alone without someone else there.
Have you had to take precautions now?
Yeah. Got to make sure that I, like, have someone to walk with to the train station and, like, when I get my car at Tukwila, and make sure I always call them when I leave class and things.
Who's been affected by this?
Mostly my mom. Yeah, she's, like, worried for everyone else, not, like, all my cousins, all my relatives, because, you know, your mother is always going to be the one that worries the most out of everyone. And this mother is all across the country who are worrying about their kids right now.
What's your mom been saying?
She's just making sure that I'm safe, calling me right before class, right after, you know, always making sure that I'm all right.
And what do you say to her?
I tell her, Mom, I love you, but I'm fine.
Do you feel fine?
Yes.
What do you think needs to happen in society, in Seattle, in the country, for people to feel safe?
I feel like more precautions should be taken up by, like, our political leaders, our congressmen, our future president, that, you know, we should be spreading diversity and acceptance for everyone, for Muslims, for everything.
Have you had other things that have happened to you in the course of your life that made you think that they were hate motivated?
You know, kids at school used to be rude because of the hijab I wore. They'd, like, pull it off and, like, make fun of me or call me bald because they couldn't see my hair. But, you know, it's just something you learn to ignore, but you wish you wouldn't have this problem, but you just have to remind yourself that it's okay.
What's your message to people out there who are hearing about your story? What's your message to them?
Stuff like this shouldn't happen to people, even because of being a Muslim or anything. Like, we're your neighbors, we're citizens, we're just like everyone else, and no one, not just Muslims, no one deserves this.
Nasra Hassan talking there with KUOW's David Hyde. She says she was struck with a bottle on the University of Washington campus on the evening of November 15th, a week after the election. A group of interfaith leaders in Seattle is going to be holding a press conference about the incident later today. They're calling for an FBI investigation of this incident as a possible hate crime, and they say they will offer a $5,000 reward for information that leads to an arrest and a conviction. Last week, a sign outside a mosque in Redmond was damaged. The president of the Muslim Association of Puget Sound, Mahmoud Kadir, says it looks like the sign was smashed and close to demolished by a sledgehammer. Kadir told me what he thought after seeing the sign last Monday morning.
The first thing occurred to me was probably it could be an accident of some type. You know, it didn't occur to me like some malicious intent is there, because, you know, it never occurred to me. But then it was really disheartening to see, you know, it's a symbol of our organization and somebody trying to destroy that possibly was conveying some type of message.
Had your center ever been the target of any kind of
attack? After San Bernardino attacks, there were a few calls that were made to the police.
These were the murders in California.
Yeah, right, yeah. After that incident happened, somebody threatened to come and, you know, kind of kill people in the center, and the police explored that further. They provided extra protection. It was only a telephone call, not to our center, but to police, saying that they're going to attack. They explored it further, but nothing happened.
How different did a physical attack on the sign feel to you?
Yeah, this was the first physical attack, and I was really concerned about, is it just proving a point, or there is some more seriousness to that particular attack, right? So today it attacked on the sign, saying, well, we can attack you, and then maybe sometime later inside the mosque, somebody might come. We have the largest center in the state of Washington. MAPS is the largest center. We serve about 5,000 families from 14 different countries. So every day you go, there is at least over 100 or 150 kids. So I was really concerned about that.
Some people have assumed this attack was linked to the Trump election. What do you think?
I really don't know, because we didn't get the full investigation, or they didn't find out yet, police, what was the motive behind it. But since the election of our president-elect Trump, there has been an increased activities all across U.S., you know, on the minorities and Muslims and the others. So it could be related to that, but I just don't have enough information to kind of say it is as a part of that.
Have you personally or anyone you know felt a change in the way your community's been treated since the election?
The interesting thing that I found in my community is between the ages of 22 to 30, that age group was kind of very hard to uplift them after the election.
Why do you think that is?
I think they were more kind of concerned with the rhetoric. They were following Mr. Trump's, you know, before the elections, and then they were actively participating in the elections. So the one thing is they got disheartened by the result. At the same time, they feel they are more vulnerable because they are participating in many of the activities in the social circles, in the education, universities, etc.
You sent a message to your congregation.
Yeah.
And you talked about shoring up your private worship, your belief.
Yeah, yeah.
You talked about participating more in your community.
Yeah.
And you also talked about giving the president-elect the benefit of the doubt. In other words, which is interesting because a lot of people are already worried and protesting and fundraising on behalf of groups like yours.
Right.
And you're saying, wait a minute, nothing's happened yet.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
There is some stuff that is going on because of rhetoric. But actually, like, for example, people are really worried that, you know, minorities will be completely sent out. For example, if you look at the Mexican people, you know, like we are our illegal immigrants to be shunted out of the country, and, you know, minorities, Muslims will be banned from other things. We haven't seen any of that in action yet, right? So I think there is a lot of talk about it, and it might come into the actions. But one of the things as a Muslim you believe is in the goodness of a human being, because the God's spirit is in you. So once you look at everything, once you realize what responsibility you have, not only for one half of the country that supported you, but the other half who did not support you. So my expectation is President-elect Trump will look at all of these set of information, which he wasn't privy before, and would do the right thing for our country. So till it is proven otherwise, you know, let's just not be worried about it. You participate in the process. You know, kind of raise your rights you have as citizens. You participate in the way that the country provides us. And if you find something which is shaking the fabric of your country, you stand up for it. But without seeing any action on it, just unnecessarily getting too worked up, I didn't feel that was the right thing for us.
What action would be crossing the line for you? For example, there's talk of a registry of Muslims either coming in from abroad, or even, you know, an extreme version would be talk about a registry at home.
Yeah, I think registry for Muslims is one. Illegal immigration, you know, the people who have come here, separating parents from their kids is another one. Trampling on the rights of the gay or lesbian community is another one. So there are a host of factors, which is the foundation of our nation, which is built on diversity of thought, diversity of race, diversity of, you know, religion. If any one of those factors is shaken, it's just not necessarily Muslim registry, but if any one of those factors are shaken, then definitely we should stand up, and within our rights to demand justice, we should not accept that which is shaking the foundation of our country. So we'll have to just see any of those actions, not just related to Muslims.
We've talked about your message to your congregation. Is there something you want non-Muslims in the Puget Sound area to do?
I am truly humbled with the overwhelming support we got from our non-Muslim friends, regular, you know, from the community. If you haven't interacted with a Muslim or if you haven't seen them, reach out to them, reach out to our center to know about the people. So most of the time, many of the misunderstandings happen because you really don't understand people, each other, even though, you know, both sides of it, right? Somebody may be honestly supporting Mr. Trump for his economic policies, not necessarily agreeing with all of that, understand what the issue is and work with them so that we can build these bridges between each other as a human being. So I honestly believe that, and if the community wants to know, I'm sure they'll find a Muslim anywhere at the workplace or the sports or a cab driver. Just have the conversation to know about, you know, what Islam is, what religion is, what thoughts are, so you feel comfortable.
Mahmoud Kadir is president of the Muslim Association of Puget Sound, discussing the damage done to the sign outside the Redmond Mosque. The mosque is going to replace the sign with a new one, and they're planning a ceremony on Friday, December 9th. And speaking of attacks on places of worship, there was a courtroom surprise today in Charleston, South Carolina. A judge granted the accused church shooter, Dylan Roof's, request to represent himself in his trial. Apparently, the lawyer for Roof didn't recommend it, and the judge said it was unwise, but he allowed it anyway, and we'll have an update later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Thanks for tuning in to The Record here on KUOW Seattle. At Standing Rock, North Dakota, you know there's a growing protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Meanwhile, a protest against another pipeline is happening north of us in Canada, where the Trans Mountain Pipeline would be even bigger than Dakota Access. It would be built next to an existing pipeline that runs from Alberta's tar sands to Vancouver, British Columbia, and it would more than double the amount of oil moving across Canada toward our waters. The Trudeau administration might approve the Trans Mountain Pipeline as early as tomorrow. Seattle Times environment reporter Linda Mapes says people in Western Washington need to be watching this Canadian pipeline.
It would carry tar sands oil, which is dirtier, extremely problematic to clean up in the event of a spill. And it is right in our backyard. So this would go all the way from Alberta to Metro Vancouver. And it would 7 times the oil tanker traffic through the Salish Sea. And you have a situation where Canadian oil producers, and of course Kinder Morgan, the largest energy infrastructure company in North America, make all the money and get all the benefits, and Washington gets all the risk.
Give us an idea what this project is, where it goes, and what its challenges are.
So environmentally speaking, you've got a range of challenges. Let's just start with the material itself. So this is diluted bitumen. So it's a very, very thick oil. It has to be mixed with a whole chemical cocktail in order to make it even flow in a pipeline. There are a lot of questions about the toxins in that material. That's a little scary, right? I mean, when you're talking about moving that much material that we're still even trying to understand the effects of, if it, you know, gets into the water, if it gets into the food chain, if it gets into the environment. So that's number one, the material itself. Number two, we're talking about spills and the potential for spills. There have been spills along that pipeline, the existing pipeline that they want to expand, in various places. You know, it can spill when you're loading it onto a tanker. It can spill when you're transporting it through the pipeline itself. There are plenty of opportunities for mishap. Kinder Morgan likes to say that in the years that that existing pipeline has been in service, which is since the 1950s, there's not been a tanker spill. Okay, well, let's now times 7 the amount of tanker traffic we're talking about. That is a 9-fold increase in the risk of a serious spill in the Salish Sea. That brings me to the third point about the risks associated with a pipeline. Where we're talking about is a very sensitive place that's already under a lot of stress from development, growing population, pollution. I mean, this is a place on which we're spending billions of dollars to try to bring back the native wildlife, make the food chain actually even function again. We just took out the Elwha Dams in the largest dam removal project anywhere in the world. That's how much we care about this place and its ecological integrity. We're trying to bring it back, not pile on.
Is there a legal or reservation land aspect to the protest?
There's a very important aspect that's very different on the other side of the border, which is some of these First Nations never ceded their lands. They did not sign treaties, as did tribes on our side of the border. That creates an interesting uncertainty in situations like this, in which really the best thing for a developer is consent, straight up unqualified consent. And if you don't have that, you quickly find yourself in all sorts of legal complications. And the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, which is a very small but mighty nation, takes the biggest brunt of the impact of this pipeline. And they have already gone on record telling the Trudeau administration, if you put this before us, we're going to come right back at you. And you know what? It's not that they don't understand development or they don't like development. They're actually very pro-business. They themselves are large developers in Vancouver. But they don't want more fossil fuel development right where they live. They already live right across the water, 2 kilometers from the existing end of the Trans Mountain pipeline. They already see tanker traffic, tug traffic. They already live right in the viewshed of a flaming, steaming, smelling refinery right next door to the tank farm and the dock for Kinder Morgan's facility. They already live with many, many industrial outfalls. When you first come over the bridge to go visit them, what do you smell? Oil. And so for them, this is a case of enough is enough.
Linda, we're talking with Linda Mapes from the Seattle Times, and we talked with you when you reported from Standing Rock. How does this compare to what's happening at Standing Rock in your mind?
Well, in my mind, this has the potential to blow up to be certainly as big and maybe even bigger. I mean, it's because it's in the part of the country that it's in the population centers that it's in. You already have a very resolute, steadfast opposition. I mean, where does it go from here? Does it get less controversial? I certainly doubt it. I mean, the other thing that you see here is each of these movements, and by the way, these are now movements. They're not about individual projects. They're about movements in terms of what should consent look like if you're a tribe? What does honoring the treaties look like if you're a tribe? What does living in a world that's paying attention to climate change look like if you're a tribe? Or for everyone else, these questions are shared and they're deeply felt and very urgent, and they're all starting to feed on each other's momentum. When the Coast Salish tribes defeated the Cherry Point coal shipping port. This was a major project. We've already sort of moved on in our minds beyond it, but let's not forget this was a $625 million coal shipping facility just outside of Bellingham. The Lummi tribe successfully defeated that solely on the strength of treaty rights. It never even went to an EIS, and that was very encouraging to Native people everywhere because what it meant was, you know, we can actually win these things. And the other thing to notice about the Cherry Point victory was the tribe brought together so many other nations in that fight all over the state of Washington on the other side of the border. Same tribes, same people coming together now on Trans Mountain. Similarly, let's look at Standing Rock. You've seen by now more than 300 Native nations turn out to support that tribe. And, you know, I just think that each one of these is beginning to fuel the momentum for the next one, and it's all kind of coming together in a movement.
What do you think happens next with Canada's Trans Mountain Pipeline?
You know, I actually think the most likely thing is that the Trudeau administration probably is going to approve it, and then it's going to go to court, and it's going to be fought over both in the courtroom and on the streets.
Seattle Times environment reporter Linda Mapes, good to see you again. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We are tweeting out a link to Linda's Seattle Times story about this Trans Mountain Pipeline protest. She calls it Standing Rock North. And again, she says it looks like the Canadian government's going to say yes as early as tomorrow, and lawsuits then follow. This is KUOW's The Record. Coming up later this afternoon, it's the most common learning disability, but it's still hard for doctors to understand what life is like for people who have it. What is it like to have dyslexia? That's coming up on KUOW's All Things Considered. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle is going to the Super Bowl of Major League Soccer. The Sounders will play in the MLS Cup Finals for the first time in team history, and they owe it to Jordan Morris, the rookie with the bad hamstring and the flu. He scored the only goal of the match last night to beat Colorado 1-0 and send the Sounders to the championship. The editor of the Prost America soccer news site is Steve Clare.
Jordan Morris right now may be the most famous soccer player in North America, maybe the most talked about sportsman. He is a young 22-year-old local kid who in his first season with the Sounders has enjoyed the most incredible highs and lows that engender the kind of media phrase, you couldn't make it up.
Yes, the local boy, he's from the Seattle area, and he was supposedly sick going into this epic semifinal game.
As well as having a hamstring injury that had made him doubtful for the first leg, and therein lies another fantastic story which I'll come to, he had got a virus-like flu or gastrointestinal problem the last 2 days, which had kept him, you know, bedridden and just resting. He overcame that, not only to play 90 minutes, but also to play in the altitude of Denver last night. And not only did he overcome that and his hamstring injury, he scored the winning goal, injured his knee while doing so, but managed to get through the rest of the match, playing an absolutely instrumental role in defending Sounders' lead.
Now, Steve, I'm depending on you here to tell me who to believe, because soccer is famous for flops. And so when somebody tells me that he has come from death's door, bedridden, to rise from the ashes and score the goal, I just always want to know, that's really how it happened? He was that sick?
Well, herein lies even better subkernel of a story. The club's doctor is also his dad. So if there's one man who would know, it's definitely him.
Okay.
And I spoke to the club this morning. His dad treated him on the pitch last night after he scored and bandaged his knee. But no one is revealing what that conversation went like. I did ask, though. But I think, you know, he's an honest player. I've been watching him all year. He's not a flopper. So I think the story is probably almost certainly true.
That's what I want to hear. So the final match, the championship game, might be in Seattle, might not. Will you explain that, please?
Yes, I can. Hosting rights go to the team who scored the most points in the regular season. That is, the games that are played before they break up for the playoffs. Seattle has scored more points than Montreal in the league, but less than Toronto. So if Toronto win Wednesday semifinal, they will host the final and Seattle will visit. However, if Montreal come out on top against their Canadian cousins, Seattle would host Montreal.
I hear the MLS final game, it's the Super Bowl of soccer, and it's a little odd not to know where the Super Bowl is going to be played, if CenturyLink Field is going to be dark or host the granddaddy of them all.
Well, the reason why they do that is the Super Bowl will attract a huge crowd, no matter what teams are in it, because it's more than a sporting event. It's a showbiz event, it's a glamour event, it's a commercial event. The actual identity of the two teams who are going to be there is not really all that important to its popularity. With MLS Cup, this all ended in 2010 when they had a final in Toronto between Dallas and Colorado, and the attendance was very poor. So MLS came to a decision that one of the sides who were playing would host it, and the fairest way to do that would be to have the side who had the best regular season. But I don't think MLS wants to go through a half-empty stadium for the showpiece event. And the best way to ensure that is to have it at one of the stadiums of the competitors.
Another amazing thing about this is the Sounders, by the way, this is their first appearance in the MLS Cup game, and they've done it without their superstar player, Clint Dempsey. He's been out with a health problem. Could he come back just for this one game?
No, he has an irregular heartbeat problem, and there's no way he'll come back. Add on to that, even if he could come back, it would be hard to see who he would displace from the team. Jordan Morris is the hero and the on-form player. And Sounders' season turned around when Nicolas Ladero arrived from Argentina. And he is a man who has set the team alight with his on-field performances and turned what was a season that was rapidly going down the drain into this. So it would be hard to see even shoehorning a healthy Clint Dempsey into something that's so obviously working well. But no, his health will prevent him playing.
Are you saying the Sounders are better without Clint Dempsey?
Yes, I did seem to be saying that, and I know we like controversy. I would say, if you press me, the Sounders team as it's currently playing is probably better than it has been all year. So I'd have to say yes and not the question.
What is your prediction then, Steve, for the MLS Cup final?
I answered the one by showing how I wasn't going to duck the question in preparation for that. So here's my fallback, Bill. As I don't know who the opponent is yet, I can't predict it. So So you'll have to invite me back in a week's time to talk about the final, because I won't be able to duck it then.
That is fair. That was some estimable ducking. No flopping involved. Nothing but admiration for that. Steve Clare from Prost America, the soccer news site. Steve, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So the Sounders will play for the MLS Cup somewhere on December 10th. They will face Toronto or Montreal. They might host the match at CenturyLink Field here in Seattle. We'll find out on Wednesday, and we'll take Steve up on his offer. We will talk again to Steve Clare, editor of the Prost America soccer news site. I don't know who we want more, Toronto or Montreal, Todd.
Toronto, I think, would be the better choice in this case.
I'm going to go with Toronto as well, then, because Todd Bishop knows everything.
That's right.
The game would be in Toronto if Toronto wins.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think maybe we should just go for Montreal. Seattle's the home team.
That sounds good. I'm on board with that.
Highly controversial, but we're staking out our position early, and we'll find out more as the MLS situation unfolds on this Monday. I don't like to call it Cyber Monday. I feel that gives national holiday status to a department store sale, but...
Well, that's the trick. That's the retail trick, right?
Yes, it is. Yes. Todd Bishop, by the way, from the Seattle tech site GeekWire. Cyber Monday is important to Amazon, so it's important to me. And how is the Black Friday to Cyber Monday stretch been going?
Well, here's the news flash. You've been buying a lot of stuff, people.
Yeah?
You really have. So Black Friday set a new record for online shopping in the U.S., more than $3 billion. Of items purchased online, either from your desktop or a smartphone or a tablet. More than 1 billion of those were mobile purchases. So this is a new record, according to statistics from Adobe, which tracks these things.
Well, we would expect a new record every year, right?
You would, but if you look at the percentage of transactions that are happening via mobile, you can see our shopping habits and the dynamics of these pseudo holidays really changing to where it's just one big, massive shopping extravaganza. The distinctions now between Cyber Monday, Black Friday, Amazon now has its voice shopping weekend. It's all getting blown up, in part because you can buy something anytime, in any way, and really...
In between the turkey and the pie, you can be shopping.
Absolutely. I had an experience with my dad. He went to Barnes & Noble the day before Thanksgiving and found a book for $30, realized that he could get it for $20 on Amazon, said to me, hey, would you mind buying this? Because you've got a Prime account and a smartphone. 2 seconds later, over Thanksgiving dinner, it was on the way to his house for free shipping. So this is just how the dynamic is changing.
I saw, I think it was in your article, Todd, that the five best-selling toys include Lego, Nerf, and Barbie. So it is 1972.
Some things never change, do they, Bill? It's amazing. But the traditional retailers that have gotten on board with the mobile apps, and especially Amazon, when you take into account the fact that, you know, it's one of those logins that you remember, right? You can get into your Amazon app at any point and order things. Mobile is really reshaping the dynamic.
You mentioned voice shopping weekend, and you've been somewhat skeptical of voice use, computer voice use. How did it go?
So this is Amazon's new effort. They say that it went very well, and it's continued, actually, into Black Friday. They say that more customers asked Alexa, what are your deals? Which is different than Alexa, what is your deal?
Yes, that's a different question. What are you implying?
On Black Friday than in any other day since voice shopping launched. So 25 times more often than just a week earlier, which means that's sort of a classic Amazon way of presenting statistics, by the way.
Uh-huh.
25 times more than a week ago, but they don't give you the actual number. So it could have been just one a week ago and now 25.
Right.
But they say Prime members made more than 30 shopping interactions with Alexa per second at 8 a.m. on Black Friday. So whether that's a big deal or not, it really depends on the scope of Amazon's business. But the point is, they're really pushing this idea of taking it even beyond smartphones into just ordering purely with your voice.
I saw an ad for Amazon's Echo competitor, Google Home.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, Google, I'm listening. Your flight to Portland is delayed by 30 minutes.
Change my dinner reservation tonight from 7:30 to 8.
Your reservation at Andina is now confirmed for 8 p.m.
That was fast. Apparently you just say, change my reservation,
That's right.
Your Google Home knows that Andina doesn't mind if you show up a half hour later.
That's right. So Google, with this new device, it costs $99. They are trying to catch up with Amazon, which already has Alexa, not only on its Echo devices, but in some third-party devices, something for your refrigerator, yes, for example. So Google's playing catch-up here. Amazon is really pushing this idea of making Alexa a portal to buy stuff.
Right.
And that's really what you're saying.
We've talked before about Amazon's problem with fake reviews. Now they're taking action. What are they doing?
They are instituting a new limit for products that are non-verified purchases. You can only do 5 reviews a week. Now, I can see you sitting there. Who on earth does 5 reviews a week?
Right.
The answer is largely people who are doing fraudulent reviews.
Uh-huh.
And so they are trying to crack down on this whole notion of people doing reviews that are not legitimate.
Except that doesn't apply to books?
That's right. It's an interesting exception. They're basically carving out books from this. And it's interesting because just imagine if they said you can only comment on books that you've purchased on Amazon. It's very different from, for example, a weed eater.
Uh-huh.
You know, the traditional discourse around books.
You seem awfully interested in weed eaters. Can you just let it go?
Yeah, that's a hint to my family that might be listening for Christmas.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's an important exception that they're making to make sure that people can comment on books and review them on Amazon, even if they have not purchased them on Amazon.
Even get a discussion going.
Exactly.
And speaking of which, some people are mad at Amazon for deleting negative reviews of Megyn Kelly's book, The Fox News Anchor. What happened there?
So this is a very difficult challenge. Amazon essentially policed these reviews, and it's gotten a lot of headlines. It just speaks to the fact that, you know, it is free speech, but not really, because it is on Amazon's platform. And so in cases like this, they will step in if they don't believe it's, you know, adding to the conversation in a meaningful way, and take reviews down.
But some people said, that was my actual genuine review. You deleted it?
And that's the problem. Sometimes it's hard to know. And that's why in the other types of products, the verified purchase is actually very important. And I would not be surprised in the future if they went to purely verified purchases being allowed to post reviews.
I've purely verified. Todd Bishop is co-founder of the Seattle tech site GeekWire. Good to talk with you, Todd.
Thanks, Bill. Go Sounders.
Go Sounders. The best Cyber Monday deals, by the way. We're going to talk about that later this afternoon. Which tech gadgets make the perfect gift? Should you worry about exploding batteries? What if your hoverboard scooter battery blows up and you call 911 on your Samsung Galaxy Note 7 and it also explodes? We're going to be getting to that this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered.